This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, Rebecca Thiel discusses light pollution's bad health effects with senior editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, J. Kelly Beatty. But first, I talk with Tim Tarantine, one of Kalamazoo County's fastest rising young leaders, who was recently named Western Michigan University's Vice President of Development and Alumni Relations. At age 37, he's already been an executive director of a nonprofit organization and now a vice president for a second time. But in a candid interview, Tarantine shares how his many successes almost didn't happen, even once dropping out of college until mentors intervened. Let's start in the beginning, so to speak.
Yeah.
You went to Kalamazoo Central High School and...
Go Giants.
Hey, go Giants. Your first job was in the Kalamazoo Public Schools. You were a home support specialist at Indian Prairie Elementary School?
I was, with a wonderful principal named Karen Alessi. And she really taught me about how to be passionate and how to care about kids and how to go the extra mile.
The next program that you worked with dealt with youth as well. Retired Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter, he has a... The Turn 2 Foundation in town.
It sounds weird to hear you say retired.
I know,
Yankee.
I know.
That's
who wants
crazy.
To say retired? But he's
no,
retired.
No, he is. That's
retired
right.
And a married man now. You were on the ground floor of an initiative they had here in Kalamazoo. It was kind of an anti-peer pressure program that dealt with keeping kids off of alcohol and drugs. His father, Dr. Charles Jeter, is that
yes,
his name?
Correct.
Yeah, that he recruited you to be part of that.
Yeah, so that's an interesting story in my life. So Proud to Be Me is the name of the program. It still exists today, of which I'm proud to say, here in Michigan and in New York. And I believe they still do a Proud to Be Me in Tampa. I'm not certain. But I can say that that job and Dr. Jeter's influence was huge on me. Actually, we were just talking about it about a month ago when I saw him. He threatened to fire me. I had stopped going to school. I was partying and having all the fun I could. I was kind of giving up on myself academically. He told me he was going to fire me if I didn't go finish my degree. He told me very clearly that there was no demand for young African-American men running around with no education. And so the woman who was working with me, Tanya Torres, who was a Western student, said, hey, I got a class this summer. I think you'll like it. You should try to come to this class and get back into school. And sure enough, I was introduced that semester to human communication. Actually, the class was female-male communication, and I was introduced to Dr. Mark Orby, who became my mentor and an academic and spiritual father in a lot of ways here on campus, and that turned my life around. So Dr. Jeter and Proud to Be Me really did a lot to turn my life around and told me that I had to go aspire to higher.
What year were you in school when you had dropped out?
I was a sophomore. It took me 7 years to get done with undergrad. I took the long, long route. I was a three-time super senior. So kids who are struggling, listen to me, please. You can make it. Your life isn't how you start.
That's an incredible segue. You've come a far way. You've been very open about the fact that you, as a child, was born in a Saginaw hospital. And your mother had abandoned you there. 2 years later, Bonnie and Bob Tarantine adopted you.
Correct. You know, since that time, I've met my biological mother. I've met my entire biological family. And we have a good relationship. It took a lot of years and a lot of healing to get through those feelings of abandonment. And when I met her and understood the world that she was facing, I began to understand and have all kinds of compassion and love for her, and I love her dearly today. Unfortunately, my biological father, I met him, and he passed away a short time after we met. But that was a tough thing to grow up with. You know, when the only person in your life who's supposed to love you lets you go, and you carry that in your heart, you carry that in your being, you don't do a lot of things very well. Relationships aren't a thing you do well. You're kind and fun, and you're the guy everybody wants to be around, but inside you're just dying. And on the other side of that reality is the power of love and of mentorship and of leadership. I mean, Bob and Bonnie Tarantine took a chance on me. Nothing I have, I earned. Everything I have has been given to me. And through what's been given to me, I've tried to take advantage of those opportunities. But, Earlene, I'm a product of what Cory Booker calls a grand conspiracy of love. And I have no doubt that who I am today and where I am today is the product of a whole lot of people supporting and praying and helping me, because I didn't start on third base.
Tell me how that experience helped shape you in working with children, first as a home support specialist and then later with the Proud to Be Me after school program, and onward as being the executive director of the Douglas Community Association. How did that inform who you were and how you responded with people?
Yeah, I don't know that it just informed. I think it dictated how I behaved. And it's taken a long time to get some victory over some of those things. But, you know, when you have had so many people step in the gap on your behalf who don't have to, there is an overwhelming sense of indebtedness. But I don't take for granted for a moment that my heart was tuned towards service. There was a lot of pain that came with that. But, Erlene, the impact that that approach had in my life and on other people's lives, because I cared about people and I cared about kids who were left behind, I'm proud of what I've tried to do to help people along the way. And it was born out of a bad place, but thank goodness we've been able to flip that a bit.
There's any number of people that you call mentors, but another one that had a great impact actually on the entire community of Kalamazoo is Dr. Charles Warfield,
sure,
who used to head the NAACP and used to do any number of other things. How did you get a close association with him, and how did he affect your life?
Wow. The impact that Chuck has had on me, it's still overwhelming. I'm sitting here talking to you with tears welling up in my eyes now.
He passed earlier this year.
Right. And he came into my life. I can't even remember when I met him.
Were you
in college?
Like
I was in high school when
you
I
were
met
in high
him.
School.
But there was no moment, right? There was no big boom that went off. When I got through at high school, I knew the Warfields. I respected them. I was, you know, known by them. And then I got to Douglas, and, you know, Chuck really cared about the community, and he was one of the first people to call me and say, hey, you know, I heard you at Douglas. What can I do to help? Let me come over and talk to you. We talked, and he and Moses Walker really became my lifeline. And Chuck Warfield and I, as he aged and I came into myself and my career, you know, this year was not just a loss to the community. I lost arguably my closest friend.
Mm.
And we talked about everything. And to have a man in his late 70s who would sit down and tell you truth about life, who would allow you to speak freely, to say those things that you can't say to everybody. There are pressures with leadership, and particularly being an African-American in leadership, that you just can't talk about with everyone. And when things happened in my life that were significant, Chuck was the first phone call I'd make. And it's been rough, to be honest with you, since he's been gone. But I've realized now that it's my turn. And so I channel my inner Chuck Warfield on a regular basis here on campus, and I try to be fair with people. I try to stand up, as he would say, on the right side of things.
You went on from the Douglas Community Association to become a vice president at Southwest Michigan First.
Yeah.
That's a regional economic development organization that's based in Kalamazoo. It also does a lot of leadership training. What have you learned about leadership?
Well, I'd have to start at the definition that changed my life. So I had the opportunity, thanks to some very generous donors some time ago, as I was in between getting out of the Douglas Community Association, moving into the new port of call to Southwest Michigan First, I had the opportunity to go to Harvard University to the JFK School to learn about leadership. And I'll tell you, I learned through my experiences and through that definition that leadership is an activity. It's an activity that you exercise, and that is so important, because I didn't know that you didn't have to be in position, you didn't have to be male, white, and have money to lead. I thought leadership was reserved for a class of people. And it's about what you do with people that makes the difference. And then, and once I got that truth, I started to study, well, who are the people and leaders I admire? What are the leadership traits and activities that make me excited, that I say, wow, I want more of that in my world? They were always people who were doing the right thing with and by people. They were the type of people that people wanted to be around, who when they walked in the room, people actually wanted to engage them in a conversation, not hide in the corner when they walked in the room. We all have had leaders that are really smart, they're really strategic, they're really tactical, but when it comes to people, they absolutely miss it. And I have learned that I can't do anything. I mean, think about where I came from. I am nothing without other people. If we don't infuse a different approach to leadership that is built on what we do with and for each other, we're going to be stuck. And we're going to be stuck in a very dangerous place of individualism that doesn't care about what happens to you. That as we learn, there's some places in economic development, we used to talk about certain communities who would rather see their own children starve than the next community's children eat. That building walls, not bridges approach. That's what happens when leadership is about a protected class of people. That's what happens when leadership is only for the few. That's what happens when people don't feel inspired and empowered. They feel defensive. And if I'm defensive, then I'm warring against you. So I learned through business and economic development that leadership is about what you do to bring people together to change the condition. And that's it. It's really just that simple. Will you have the courage to act? Will you have the courage to act on behalf of what's good to bring people together? And will you be committed to leaving things better than you found them, leaving more than you found?
Any philosophies that you like to live by?
Yeah, I think Wes Moore, who I got to meet through Catalyst University and you know, South of Michigan First and Catalyst and the team there really prepared me. I mean, they did a great job of...
Well, that started about 6 years ago.
Yeah.
It provides about a day or day and a half of...
Leadership development. Yeah, it's coming up this January, and I'm actually speaking this year,
believe it or not.
Yeah, so I'm excited about that. But Wes Moore came to Catalyst, and Wes is a well-known author, and if you don't know his book, The Other Wes Moore is a outstanding book and story. But he's an African-American gentleman. He's got accolades too long to mention here. But he said something that just rocked my soul. He said that we are not products of our environment. We are products of our expectations. And I went, whoa. I mean, it knocked me out, because what that says to me is really my life story, that we're not necessarily how we got started. We're not even the environments we are in today. We are simply the products of what we expect from ourselves and of others. And having those expectations for ourselves, expecting better, expecting the world to get better, expecting our work to matter, just our expectations are everything. And I would just encourage our listeners today, no matter if you're a multimillionaire sitting on your boat listening to the interview, or you're a kid struggling trying to figure out who you are and where your next meal's going to come from, you are not your environment. You are not what happened to you. You have capacity to be everything you expect. And I don't care what the naysayers or people who haven't experienced that truth in their life say to you, I'm a witness that God and hard work and love can transform anything, because it has me.
We've been talking to Tim Tarentine, Western Michigan University's new Vice President for Development and Alumni Relations. For a longer version of this interview, go online to WMUK.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.
We know that light pollution makes it harder to see the stars, but those of us who aren't astronomers or stargazers might not know that it also causes health problems and wastes billions of dollars in electricity every year. J. Kelly Beatty is the award-winning senior editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. On November 4th, he'll give a talk as part of the Kalamazoo Astronomical Society's 80th anniversary celebration. And he's here with me on Skype. Hi, Kelly.
Hey.
Those of us who are not stargazers, you know, may not understand why we should pay attention to this problem. So, you know, convince us.
Really, the loss of starry night skies is a societal problem. You know, it's a quality of life issue. You touched on the stargazers and the astronomers, and I think there's a little of that in all of us, really. I'm sure those of us who've had the chance to go outside under a pitch dark sky and see the Milky Way arcing overhead, or a lovely crescent moon, or, you know, all those stars out there, are just sort of compelled to think big thoughts about where we came from, what our place in the universe is, what does it all mean. And so the fact that we have been robbed of that right to see a dark sky is really sad. And it's hurting us in a kind of sense of civilization and a sense of self.
Not only that, but we're not sleeping as well because of this problem. Can you kind of explain that aspect?
Our bodies, when we're asleep, create a compound called melatonin. It's created by a little gland in the brain called the pineal gland. And that gland only secretes melatonin when it's dark outside. In fact, a little more than a decade ago, research showed that there's a sensor in the eye that has nothing to do with vision. It's essentially a trigger, an on-off switch, if you will, for the pineal gland that tells it that it's dark, so it should make melatonin. Now, we don't fully understand melatonin's role in our body's health, but studies have shown that melatonin can suppress the growth of cancer tumors in mice. And so there's some thought that there's a link between the degree to which we have melatonin in our system and the corresponding degree that we can diminish cancers in our system. This was just a theory until like the late 1980s, a researcher named Stevens put this to a test, and he found that statistically, those who worked night shifts, little nurses or factory workers, had a significantly higher risk for developing breast cancer in women and prostate cancer in men. And it was a strong enough link that the International Agency for Cancer Research has declared night shift work to be a probable carcinogen, you know. So people who've done this for a very long time are literally at higher risk for developing cancer. Now, a point to make here is that the kind of light that you're exposed to, you know, on the floor of a factory or in a hospital ward at night is far higher than most of us are when it's asleep at night or when there's, you know, a streetlight coming into our window. But the point of all this research is that it disrupts the circadian cycle. It disrupts the production of melatonin in our system. And as I mentioned, separately in lab studies with rats, it's been shown that melatonin can suppress the growth of cancer. So it's, you know, a lot of it in terms of human health is circumstantial. It's certainly the case that a lack of melatonin in our system, you know, like when we take a red eye flight or we're up late and we can't produce that melatonin, we end up feeling cranky and fatigued. And so there's a general sense that melatonin is influential in our overall immune system. And so we want to get as much melatonin as we can. And darkness is key to that production, just in terms of a natural day-night cycle.
In an article that you wrote for the Sun Journal, I believe that was in Maine, specifically you said that most lights are not aimed at the ground, that they're aimed other places, you know, sometimes just in the case of businesses, sort of into the atmosphere. You know, why do we do this, and what could we do to stop these misdirected lights?
That's a great. I won't name any names, but the businesses, especially those that are open at night, strong lighting to draw customers in. Stations, fast food establishments are all trying to get your attention, and so often they create a lot of lighting that is indiscriminate. It goes well beyond the needs for just, you know, pumping gas or whatever. Also been the case that tens of millions of streetlights that were installed in the 1950s and 60s have a kind of glass bottom to them, shaped like a salad bowl, if you can imagine that. And the light bulb for those streetlights is light mostly on the ground, but some of it goes up into the sky. Or you can imagine a convenience store near you that's trying to illuminate its parking lot by slapping lighting fixtures, we call them wall packs, on the side of the building and having them shine sideways into the parking lot. Well, a lot of that light ends up going up instead of down. So all these reasons are wasteful. Now, there's some good news in that the lighting industry, response to the needs of us and consumers, has started designing a lot of lighting that is more efficient. If you go to any development, a business park or something like that, and look at the lighting, you'll see that they've been designed to shine the light straight down and not up. And reasons for that have really very little to do with being environmentally aware. It's all about the economics. If you can put all of the light generated on the ground, you don't need to generate as much light. You use a lower wattage bulb. You save electricity.
You know, it's funny to think about things like streetlights. A lot of us think that streetlights are, you know, if we didn't have them, we might more likely run into a deer. But you say that there are actually ways that this lighting can hinder our driving.
Yeah, so if the streetlight is designed poorly and it shines in your eyes, it creates glare. And that glare inhibits your ability to see well at night. And let me draw this example. You're driving alone at night on a dark country road and your headlights are shining out in front of you. You know that your eyes kind of get adapted to the dark. Your pupils dilate and you can see better when it's dark after your eyes have been exposed to the darkness a while. If another car is coming at you with its high beams on, or even if not, your pupils constrict, and so not enough light gets into your eye to see in those dark shadows along the side of the road, and you're momentarily kind of seeing as well until that car passes. Same with streetlights. If a streetlight is designed poorly, or if you're passing a used car lot with strong lighting on it, you're unable to see as well as you otherwise might be. Now, there's definitely a place for streetlights. If you talk to a lighting designer, they'll say, you know, we want to put lights where there are what's called conflict zones at intersections, or where you've got a crosswalk where people are crossing the road and you want to be able to see them far, far ahead of when your headlights would otherwise show you these people in the crosswalk. So it's not to say that there's no place for streetlights, but we want to design them with the least amount of glare possible. And that generally means designing them so that all of their light goes down and not out.
The International Dark Sky Association says that the United States wastes more than $3 billion worth of energy a year. But also, and this is something that I didn't consider before this interview, these lights also release 21 million tons of carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas associated with climate change.
Yeah, the streetlights themselves don't do that, but the power plants that are needed to generate that much electricity are. You know, it's an odd thing about power plants. They like to run 24/7. And so if you think back to the post-World War II years, power plants were looking for a way to use the electricity that they generated at night when a lot of people weren't using very much electricity. And so companies like Westinghouse and General Electric made it very attractive for towns and cities to install lots and lots, millions of streetlights as a way to use this sort of excess electricity at night. And in a very real sense, the vast networks of streetlights that we have are in part a legacy of that time. A lot of those streetlights go back to that time.
But there are actually some articles that came out saying that LEDs are brighter, and thus, as we use more of them for things like streetlights, we're actually contributing to more light pollution. So what's your thought on this?
So your eye at night uses different sensors than we do during the daytime. You know, just looking around during the daytime, we use what are called cones in our eyes. At night, it switches over to a black and white system that's very sensitive to light called rods. And the rods are extremely sensitive to blue light, such that even with the two lights emitting the same amount of light coming out of them, the same number of photons, the one with the bluish light will seem much brighter. much harsher. And so one of the problems with LEDs is they're most efficient when they emit the bluest light. And so if you're a municipal planner and you're trying to put streetlights on your roads and you're trying to get the, you know, the best efficiency and the most light for the dollar, you would be biased toward getting these blue rich LEDs. The problem is people don't like them. It's been shown all over the country that they seem harsh, they seem bright, it gives kind of an alien landscape. And we're getting the International Dark Sky Association, which you mentioned, and which I hope we can talk a little more about, has recommended that any outdoor LED have a color temperature of no higher than 3000 Kelvin. And that's a color temperature that we would call soft white or warm white. And it's actually quite pleasant to the eye. And in particular, it doesn't have as much of this blue component to it. And why is that important? Turns out that this blue light is the highest energy, and it's the most disruptive in terms of the nighttime environment, animals. It's also the blue light is most easily scattered in the atmosphere, and it creates the most amount of light pollution. So it's something I could just do without in my nighttime environment, and the IDA is recommending in that direction.
Now, you know, a lot of the things that we've talked about related to light pollution have been businesses, have been governments. What can we, you know, the average person do to help decrease light pollution?
Yeah, so you can work even locally. I'll give an example. Let's say you're just a homeowner by yourself and you've got a security light out in the back that's on from dusk to dawn all night, every night. Well, first of all, that's using a lot of electricity. What I would recommend for an individual is that consider switching that light to one that's on a motion sensor so that the light only comes on when there's something in your yard that's disturbing, you know, that's within range. Just doing that alone, you can, the money that you would save in electricity would pay for that motion sensor within the first 6 months. Broadening out, in your neighborhoods, there are always, when a new business is coming in, that business will come before the planning board of your local town and have to pass all kinds of regulations, you know, plumbing and heating and safety, the size of parking lots, all kinds of stuff, the strength of the building. Ask your local planning board if they'd consider working on a set of lighting requirements that would minimize the amount of light pollution that these new businesses create. This is especially true if that business happens to be located near a residential area. And then more broadly, your town can create lighting bylaws that regulate the amount of light and save energy. Maybe your town itself is in the process of switching over to LEDs for streetlights. Get involved in that process, find out what's going on, and argue for streetlights that are not too bright, that are not too blue, and that maybe have controls on them that will switch them off in the wee hours of the morning, say from midnight to 5 a.m., when they're not needed as much.
J. Kelly Beatty, senior editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. And I just want to mention in closing, if your listeners want more information, they can go to the IDA's website, which is darksky.org. Very easy to see. And there's all kinds of resources available there for them.
J. Kelly Beatty will give a talk tomorrow night at 7 at the Kalamazoo Area Math and Science Center. It's part of the Kalamazoo Astronomical Society's 80th anniversary celebration. I'm Rebecca Thiel. This is WMUK's West Southwest.